Welcome to this ABC Radio National podcast. For more on other enjoyable and informative programs, listen after the end for details. But right now, here's your podcast, which we hope you enjoy.
Hello and welcome to the Media Report. I'm Anthony Fennell and this is ABC Radio National. There's been quite a deal of comment online these past few weeks over plans for a new government-regulated internet filtering system for Australia. Now, last year, the Howard administration released a filter package that people could install onto their home computers in order to screen out sites they thought were either objectionable and or dangerous. The Howard government's approach was about choice, giving people the option to choose whether or not they wanted to use such a filter. But now its successor, the Rudd government, has decided there's a need for a mandatory filtering system to screen all Australian computers. Their plan will require internet service providers, or ISPs, to block sites designated to be harmful, therefore preventing ordinary Australians from being able to access them. Now, as you can imagine, there are already questions being raised about what sort of sites will be banned by the government and what sort of public transparency there'll be to the entire process. The Minister for Communications is Senator Stephen Conroy.
Well, what we're proposing is that we actually have an election commitment. It was stated clearly before the election to protect Australian families and kids from some material that is currently on the net. Now, at the moment, there is illegal material on the net, things like child pornography, things like ultra-violent sites. And so what we're seeking to do is take technology and actually enforce the existing law. Now, no one is suggesting, I don't think so far that I've heard, that people want to be able to access child pornography sites or should be able to access child pornography sites. So just to give this a context, we're seeking to use new and emerging advances to block access to sites like that.
But as you'd be aware, I mean, there are reports that various senators, including Nick Xenophon and Steve Fielding from Family First, there have been reports that they're keen to see access to sites like online gaming sites and also general pornography sites included as banned sites with this filter. What's your view on that, and is that a consideration being taken into account by the government?
This is a long-standing election commitment. We made this commitment back when Kim Beazley was leader of the Labor Party. So just to give you an indication, this is a long-standing position that we've been advocating.
But could things like general pornography sites and gambling sites be included on the list of banned sites?
Well, as I said, what we're seeking to do is implement our election commitments, and senators should be aware what our election commitments are. There's been a number of wild and inaccurate assertions about what Labor's policy is. And let me be clear, we are committed to work with the industry to see if it is technically feasible. That's why we've conducted a laboratory test and we're moving to conduct a live test with ISPs. And that's Labor's policies. At this stage, we're at the very early stages of working with the industry because there's a lot of claims about the degradation of the internet. If I could just address those for a minute. You've seen the sort of filtering we're talking about introduced in a range of other countries like the UK, Sweden, Norway, France and New Zealand, and there has been no determinable effect
but
on
Senator,
internet speed or performance.
Senator, a lot of people will be concerned about what will be on that list of banned sites.
Who
will determine what are the banned sites, and will that list of banned
sites? There's actually a list today.
Well, what will be included on those sites?
Well, there's actually an existing list. I mean, people are saying suddenly, where's this list come from? It actually exists today. If offensive content is hosted by Australian ISPs now, and when I say offensive, refused classification content, then it gets issued with a takedown notice today. This is an existing blacklist. So people are trying to, a whole range of people have said, hey, well, let's expand this. That's a debate that we will come to. What we're trying to establish at the moment, we're no further than establishing at the moment whether it's technically feasible. So in terms of what some other senators want to claim should be included on the blacklist, I'm sure that when we get to the debates down the track, if it proves to be technically feasible, there'll be a whole range of people with a whole range of demands about what should be on the blacklist. But what we've committed to do is practically implement what's on the blacklist at the moment, if it is technically feasible. So, as I said, a lot of wild claims have been made, and now a number of new senators have bought into the debate, the Greens, Xenophon, Fielding, and they've all got ideas about what they think should or shouldn't be on the blacklist. I mean, as an example, I had an argument, or not an argument, I had a discussion at Senate Estimates with a Green senator who believed that euthanasia websites shouldn't be blacklisted, but they're currently illegal under the existing laws. So there's people who would argue something should be taken off the list, and there's people who argue something should be included in this list. So let me be clear. This is about establishing whether or not it is technically feasible. We're no further down the process than that.
The Communications Minister, Stephen Conroy. So that's the intent, but what about the practicality? Can the sort of filtering system Senator Conroy is planning actually work? Mark Pesce is a regular guest on the ABC's New Inventors program, and he's an honorary lecturer in digital cultures at the University of Sydney.
In any open society, any system that attempts to filter the internet is basically going to run up against the wishes and intents of the people who are using the internet to get what they want. I think an analogy that you could use is if you could imagine you have a highway and there's a pile up on the highway and cars are all stopped from going in one direction, and that's basically the filter. Well, are those cars just going to sit there? No, they're going to actually find another route to their destination. And that's essentially what's going to happen when you try to censor the network. There's a rule called Gilmore's Law. John Gilmore, one of the founders of Sun Microsystems, so one of the very first companies that really understood how to use the internet. Back in 1993, he said that the network regards censorship as damage and routes around it. So if you try to censor anything on the internet, it's not so much that the network itself will find its way, but it's the people who are the network will find their way around to any information that they want.
So in terms of that central question about blocking child pornography, and, you know, no decent person would say that law enforcement authorities shouldn't be doing their best to stop child pornography, but, you know, that central question about blocking it, you have serious doubts, do you, that this type of filter will be effective in that regard?
Well, it's because the entire question of child pornography is a bit of a canard. Child pornography is not something that's just sort of freely and openly available. Child pornography is distributed by human social networks. It may be distributed through electronic means, but it's distributed by individuals who know each other because they understand how dangerous it is to hold this material. And so law enforcement always works by disrupting those human networks, not by disrupting the technical networks. And so it's a bit of a canard to say that this is being implemented to protect us from child pornography.
The Minister for Communications says countries like the UK, France and Sweden all have internet filtering schemes. If they can make it work, isn't it reasonable to try something similar here?
But the question is, are they making it work? I mean, they have systems, but there's no indication that these systems are ever effective anywhere they're implemented. They'll either produce a false positive, so people would not be able to go to a site about breast cancer because it had the word breast in the title, or something like that. So they'll give a false positive, or they'll simply be ineffective because they won't filter out what you want. That's not going to be any less true for a system in the UK or in France or in Sweden than it would be in Australia. Now, Australia's system, as has been described by the senator, is more comprehensive. There are more categories covered, which means it would create more false positives.
And I know that you have argued in the past that, systems are actually designed. There is technology out there to help people in oppressive regimes to hide their identity when they're searching for things on the net for, you know, reasons of democracy, that kind of thing. So presumably, Australians, if this net filtering system does come in, some of them will be using some of those systems, some of those technologies that already exist.
Yeah, I've already been talking to Australians about something called Tor, or the Onion Router, which was a system that was developed for people in countries where they don't have freedom of speech issue, in the case of maybe China or Iran or areas like that. And it basically allows you to take the computer and just by running a piece of software on your normal computer and browsing normally, it basically, what they say is that it anonymizes it. It makes it impossible to track where you're going or where the information is coming from. So there's no way that you can effectively filter against it. This software is very easy to use. And one of the things that I've been doing is I've been doing my best to make sure that people in Australia know how to use it. Already Australians use BitTorrent, the file sharing program that's used to distribute television and movies and other things. They use that more more often than any other people on the planet. And I suspect that if Conroy gets his filter in, we will also be the biggest per capita users of Tor, because Australians will be using it to get their internet unfiltered.
Now, there's been a lot of talk in the press over the last couple of weeks about the, you know, a possible unintended consequences of an internet filtering system in terms of slowing down internet speeds. What can you tell us about that?
Well, as near as we can tell, with the small test that they ran, it slowed down the access speeds by about 86%. So it would take us from a nation that's not particularly fast in our broadband to a nation that's much more molasses-like in broadband. Now, whether this is going to be truly annoying or noticeable, it's going to be something that's going to be there. And the more aggressive that the government is about detecting things that are unacceptable, the slower that is, the more processing that's required. And that's essentially going to be a cat and mouse race, because not only is the filter going to be easy to get around using technologies like Tor, not only is the filter going to give you false positives, but it's actually going to ruin the quality of the internet experience. So it's going to be a lose-lose-lose situation.
Do we know what some of the ISP, the internet service providers, what they think about this move?
Well, there have been some statements. Someone who runs an ISP in South Australia, as a private citizen, sent a letter off to his MP detailing all of the reasons why he thought this was a bad idea. And some of the things that we talked about were in that. Really, the ISPs don't want to have to be made the policemen in this situation, and they don't see that there's any need, because the perception of the internet is that, yes, there are things out there that are untoward and you can go out and find them, but they are not being pushed at you. And if they're not being pushed at you, then why should the ISPs have upon themselves the responsibilities of blocking it?
Mark Pesci from the University of Sydney. Now, as was mentioned earlier, there are already personal filters available to help parents screen the net. And there is the service NetAlert, set up by the government to provide advice and assistance to parents on the issue of online safety. Another organisation people turn to for help is the not-for-profit group called Young Media Australia. Its president is Jane Roberts.
Young Media Australia gets a lot of contact either through the national helpline that we have or by our internet site ourselves. And whilst there is a growing number of contacts where people, I have to say, are actually quite confused about the internet filtering tools that are out there, and also about their sense of relying on one tool to actually keep their young children safe from the internet. So what we try and promote is that there are a number of filtering tools, but also that those tools are not infallible, and that they actually must be supplemented by, if you like, some sort of parental or carer vigilance.
And how fallible are they? I mean, you know, not knocking them, but how easy are they to crack from your experience?
Well, the wonderful thing about young people these days is that they're actually often far more savvy than their parents who are providing the computer and the material for them. And from our experience, we've heard that some of these filters are, you know, really only as good as the clever children that are out there that tend to, find ways to work around it. I guess that filters themselves are there as a safeguard, and that if people feel that those safeguards don't always work, it then makes them realise that they need to be using other strategies along with that filter.
But as you said, there is confusion about how people go about this, about what these filters will actually do and how they should use them. Is that correct?
Yes, I mean, we try on our website, we try and tell parents that, look, you know, they can block access to certain websites, whether they're based on, you know, banned sites or particular words. You know, they can stop a search engine from going in to search for a particular topic that a parent might think is not suitable. They can block access to, you know, news groups and chat rooms, and they sometimes can even set control on how much time a child can spend online. So there's a range of things that these can do. But my understanding from some of the feedback that we've got is that, you know, parents still don't always understand how they work. And again, as we will always say, that internet filters are one tool in a toolkit of ideas that parents need to use if they would like their children to be safe when using an internet.
Jane Roberts, the president of the not-for-profit organisation Young Media Australia. and this is the Media Report, available across the world via your choice of platforms, be it online, podcast, or terrestrial broadcast, through ABC Radio National and Radio Australia. I'm Anthony Fennell. It hasn't been a good year for the magazine trade overall, with falling sales and the sort of advertising uncertainty that's plagued the print business in general. But where some see gloom, others see potential. Tomorrow, a new Australian version of the British magazine, The Week, will be on sale in newsagencies across the country. Now, there are two things about The Week that make it interesting from our perspective. The first is that while it's a print publication, it adopts the very same aggregationist approach to news gathering that we're now so familiar with online. And the second is that its Australian editor-in-chief is David Salter, the former executive producer of the Media Watch program on ABC TV. I caught up with David Salter and also The Week's managing director for the UK and Australia, Kieran O'Connor, a few days ago. Well, gentlemen, welcome to the program.
Great to be here.
Thank you for having us.
David, let's start with you. Conventional wisdom might say that given the state of world economics at the moment, this is not the ideal time to be launching a new magazine. What would you say to conventional wisdom?
Well, first of all, Anthony, you know that I never really take much notice of conventional wisdom. And the second thing is, I see it as an opportunity. I mean, what there is a huge amount of interesting and vibrant stuff out there that should be covered, that should be in front of Australians, and they should have the best possible choice of everything across the board. And that's what The Week does. It's not just one voice. We're distilling maybe 100 voices every week to equip Australians with all the information they need to cope with these uncertain times. If you're asking me about can the magazine work economically, I'm absolutely convinced it can, because it's a good model. It's proved popular both in the UK and America, and there's no reason Australians won't have an appetite for it as well.
Kieran O'Connor, you'd be aware that for the past year, the magazine business in Australia has been doing it extremely tough, declining copy sales, advertising revenue going down as well. What attracted you to expand into this Australian market at this particular point in time?
Well, I think I'd start by saying that there's a rich history of opinion in the media down in Australia, which has attracted us. I think it's very important for a magazine like The Week that there's a spirit of debate which exists inside the newspapers, the radio and the TV and online. So we were attracted by that kind of depth and variety. So Australia had been in our sights for many, many years as being the next place to expand. I think what's happened for a brand like The Week is that we've realised that the model we have, it's not recession-proof and it's certainly not kind of media-proof, but it's a very good magazine model to take into the 21st century. We are reliant on heavy levels of subscriptions, and we do very, very well with this kind of elite consumer who wants to understand about what's really happening inside the world. So we feel very confident about The Week as an entity that it will continue to flourish going forward.
It is a small market, though, isn't it, the Australian market?
Small but perfectly formed.
Look, given your experience in the UK, could I get you to give us just a bit of an indication of the sorts of international trends we're seeing in magazine sales? You know, what types of magazines are actually doing well? What types aren't?
I think the first thing that we're seeing, certainly back in the UK, is increasingly that the hero brands are living for longer. So as times begin to become harder, more money is slipping towards the market leaders, the ones and twos in the sectors. The other thing that we're seeing continuing to exist and to in many ways flourish is what I call the special interest titles. So anything related to something where people have to buy something at the end, a car, you know, fishing or sailing. The special interest titles are doing well. I think the larger titles who are more heavily geared towards promotion and heavy newsstand are the ones which are probably finding this market the toughest.
And we know that the bloke magazines here in Australia, and I presume in the UK, have suffered tremendously over the last 12 months. Also, a lot of the sort of trashier women's magazines. That hasn't necessarily been the case with quality magazines, though, has it?
I think that's absolutely right. I think the internet is drawing off a lot of those consumers for the broader ones, particularly, as you say, with the bloke titles. I was involved with men's magazines for many, many years, and I think a lot of that readership has moved onto the internet. I think it's the same for the gossip titles as well. I think at the quality end, you're more likely to have consumers who enjoy reading, want to spend time with it, appreciate the love and care which has gone into crafting these kind of fantastic products like The Week.
David Salter, The Week is a bit of a bowerbird of a magazine, isn't it? In that, you know, it's largely made up of stories sourced from other publications. Could I get you to talk to us about that approach? Why you feel that approach will be successful?
Well, I appreciate bowerbird as an Australian allusion. I like to think of it more as jackdaw journalism, if you know what jackdaws do, which is, they're very, very selective as to what they pinch and put in their nest. I think it's important to dispel a misconception. We're not a digest. We don't just cut and paste other people's material and republish it. We do much, much more work than that. What we do is we collect a broad range of opinion and commentary and review and criticism, and then we distill the very best of that, and we rewrite most of it. I mean, our style is, I've described as a mixture of aggressive paraphrase and select quotation. The direct quotes are very short. They're there to give sort of the flavour, the pepper, if you like, in the mix. But it's our journalistic work that pulls that all together.
So, I think so you are offering something new.
Absolutely.
You're not just taking bits and pieces from other people's publications.
No. If we were to do that, it would be dull and pedestrian, and it wouldn't add any value. Our magazine adds huge value because we go right across the spectrum on a given issue, whether it's political, cultural, social, whatever, business, and we get the very best of what we think has been written about it, and we sit down, work out how to balance that out, then pick the eyes out of it and make a news story out of it, so that you might get, with us, 450 words, let's say, on the rescue package, Rudd's rescue package for the economy, but it won't be just one view. It'll be a beautifully balanced version of six competing views on that.
But can't people already do what you're going to do for them? Can't they already do that themselves online? I mean, there are sites that offer the best of quality journalism from around the world.
Well, there are many sites which do that, and in many ways you'd think that the internet should have killed The Week. The internet probably should have come along and said, oh, we can do a much better job than human beings in terms of doing that. Well, actually, the internet's very bad at selecting it for this kind of consumer. What it can really do is offer you multiple exit points. What The Week does is it says, listen, this is the most important thing that you have to understand about this week, and this is the most incisive and informative comment that's been produced on this issue. If you go to Google News and you type in Kevin Rudd on the recent issues for the banks, my guess is you'll probably get somewhere in the region of about 2,500 sources. There's absolutely no way that any consumer, particularly people who have very fast lives, are able to stay on top of that. So what we do is we look at all those sources and choose the three that really count and then turn them into an entertaining piece of journalism.
How do you deal with rights issues? Because I presume that a lot of these publications where your material is sourced from, where your journalism is sourced from, initially, they wouldn't be happy with this, would they, with this approach?
Oh, no, they've been delighted with it, actually. I think one of the things that's really marked out The Week since its early days has been the support from the newspaper industry. You know, we've been very lucky with testimonials in the early days of The Week when we were publishing from a garage in Paddington, when we were selling about 1,000 copies, that nearly every newspaper editor in town was reading us, and we had a long succession of letters from them explaining why they thought they had the most important view and why we should have run them instead.
I think one of the things to bear in mind too, Anthony, is that we're not critical. We're not a review of the media in the sense that Media Watch was a review. I mean, my colleagues, I'm told, lived in fear and loathing of being mentioned on Media Watch. The opposite will be true of The Week. They'll actually love being mentioned on The Week because we're always putting forward what we believe to be the best. And bear in mind, we're not ripping them off. I mean, this stuff is out there in the public domain, and as long as our direct quotation is fair and fast and accurate, then they can have no beef with it. And as Karen has said, mostly they love seeing themselves in The Week.
David, you mentioned Media Watch there. Of course, most Australians would know you as the executive producer, long-time executive producer of Media Watch. This must be a bit of a refreshing change for you, I would imagine, you know, searching out the best of journalism rather than looking for the faults, if you like.
Absolutely. It's been terrific fun. Let me say, first of all, that the most rewarding thing so far has been the pleasure of going out and hiring a dozen good journalists. That doesn't happen that much these days. And to put together a team who I know are going to be fantastic. And we've already done three dummies, and the quality has been extraordinary. We've had congratulations from America and the UK already just on the dummies. And the other thing is, you're quite right. It's a beautiful thing to get up in the morning and be reading my papers, listening to the radio, scrolling through my favourite sites and saying, what is there good here that I can put in the magazine? In a previous incarnation, I was sort of thinking the other way around.
And now, we hear all the time that quality journalism is drying up. That there are less specialist programs, there are less investigative reporters. If that is the case, and if that trend, particularly with newspapers, continues over time, what does that mean for a publication like The Week in terms of sourcing that quality journalism from around the world?
There's no shortage of quality journalism in Australia or overseas. I think what's happening is, and I don't mean this as a reflection on your question, is that people are being more judgmental about the actual practice of journalism, you know, the ethics behind it, the style of writing, whether people recognise the line that divides opinion from news. Those issues don't really concern us because we're only picking the very cream. And that's one of the great strengths of The Week, is that we're getting rid of the dross. I do this joke with the staff where I say, we only take the pith.
Karen O'Connor, now sure. I know that the US edition of your magazine has a corresponding website. Are there plans for an Australian website further down the track?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, at the moment, we're in the process of developing our website in the UK, and we expect to be able to announce plans for that later next year. I think the primary audience for The Week is for curious people who are smart. You know, what we do is we exist as an informative and entertaining briefing to hit people who are in that kind of range of 35 to 54 who are you know, the business leaders or the societal leaders or the cultural influencers in Australia. And those are the kind of people who live busy and full lives who really need to understand precisely what's happening in Australia and around the world. And I think the trick of The Week is to target those people and to find the time to do the things that they love. And in the UK, over half of our readership has come from recommendation or from word of mouth. So this is a very kind of powerful audience, and when they adopt a magazine, they will talk about it to their friends. And in fact, our chairman, Felix Dennis, is on record as describing the magazine as heroin on paper.
Well, Karen O'Connor and David Salter, I'd like to say good luck with the publication, but that might be seen as picking favourites, so I'll just say thank you very much for joining us.
Our pleasure.
Thank you.
And the magazine is called The Week, and as I said earlier, it goes on sale across Australia from tomorrow. Now, as you've probably already heard, James Packer has all but abandoned the media business, resigning a few days ago from the board of the PBL Media Group, which owns Channel 9 and ACP magazines. The resignation made news, of course, but in truth, it wasn't really much of a surprise, as Mr. Packer had long ago signalled his disinterest in both television and print. One person who is still interested in the media business, though, and in the world in general, is Rupert Murdoch. In fact, many people, including the ABC's own managing director Mark Scott, now talk about Murdoch as being the last best hope for the survival of newspapers. Well, this Sunday, at 5 p.m. on Big Ideas on ABC Radio National, Mr. Murdoch will deliver the first of six Boyer lectures for 2008. The title of the series is A Golden Age of Freedom. Here's just a taste.
By most measures, the rule of law, economic performance, and the quality of life, Australians today live in one of the most ideal societies on earth. Indeed, when The Economist listed the world's 10 most livable cities, Australia had four of them, Melbourne, Perth, Adelaide, and Sydney. That is a tremendous achievement and an advantage in a world competing ferociously for talent and capital. Here's my worry. While Australia generally does well in international rankings, those rankings can blind us to a larger truth. Australia will not succeed in the future if it aims to be just a bit better than average. Specifically, I believe that we need to revive the sense of Australia as a frontier country and to cultivate Australia as a great centre of excellence. Unlike our parents and grandparents, this new frontier has little to do with the bush or the outback. Today, the frontier that needs sorting is the wider world, and complacency is our chief enemy.
Rupert Murdoch there. And as I said, you can catch the first of his Boyer lectures this Sunday on Big Ideas. And of course, if you miss those lectures, or Sunday just isn't a good radio listening day for you, they will be available from the Radio National website. That's abc.net.au/rn. As always, my thanks to the Media Report's producer, Andrew Davies, and also to Costa Zulu, who took care of our technical assistance this week. I'm Anthony Fennell, and this is ABC Radio National.
My name is Bruce.
I've got about 18 sets of seven dwarfs.
It's another crisp, clear night here on my street.
Every street has a story.
He's somewhat of a chatter to people in the neighbourhood.
Venture outside and it sounds like there's a war going on.
It's not too late to tell us the story of your street. and you can be inspired by downloading or streaming Street Stories My Street Sampler from the Radio National website.